Bruno?
To 1966. The year one.
Welcome to Rosemary's Baby 666, the podcast where we look at every unspeakable 6 minutes and 66 seconds of the horror 1968 masterpiece Rosemary's Baby. My name is Susan Tekla Kruglenska, and we are on episode number 11. We begin this 6 minutes and 66 seconds with Rosemary standing in front of the Time Life building looking very glum. And we end it at a party with her friend Elise saying, "How do you like that CC Hill? Isn't he a dream boy?" And Rosemary's and Rosemary saying, but I'm not going to him. And my illustrious, and I mean illustrious, guests this week include a person who is currently 2,566 miles away. That's a 44-hour drive. The best coast, the coast so much better than this coast that I cry every day thinking about it. On the sunny, sunny side, Megan Dooley.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Also, clap.
Clap. Thank you. We were trying to 3-2-1 clap to sync ourselves, and we just couldn't do it. That's how professional we are. And once again, we have also in the group from a bunch of blocks over, if you go that away, you get to Queens and you get to New Yorker cartoonist Joe Nader.
I don't even know who I am, but I'm so happy to be here to talk about the horror film Bridget Jones's Baby.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Is that it? Oh no, wait, I'm sorry. I watched the wrong movie, but it was horrifying. It was one of the scariest things I've ever seen in my life.
It's VV scary, as her diary might note.
Yes, exactly.
It is.
Exactly. By the way, I love Renee Zellweger. Love her. I don't know why people are so hard on her.
No shade. Okay. No, she's not the problem. It's society that's the problem.
I agree.
Yeah, she's the next Joker. I actually weirdly liked the first Bridget Jones movie. It's a terrific romantic comedy.
Oh yeah,
it's hilarious. She's great.
She's fine.
Completely
it's
convincingly
movie.
British, and
yeah,
it works totally. And I was taken to see it by a female friend of mine, and it was like, oh, this is a chick flick. You're gonna hate it. No, it was great. It's terrific. What are the good movies with baby in the title? By the way,
Baby Face,
like Genius Babies. Baby Geniuses?
That's not a movie.
Yes, it
Baby
is.
Baby Geniuses?
Yeah, there is.
Oh, Baby Geniuses. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said Baby Jesus. I thought that was like Muppet Babies. It's after they did the story of Jesus, then they did Baby Jesus.
Manger Babies.
Like mm-hmm. Baby Yoda, you know.
Jim Henson's Manger Babies. Yeah.
I never saw Baby Driver, which is supposed to be good. A lot of these could be combined with Rosemary's Baby. Like Rosemary's Baby's Day Out would be hilarious, I think. Three Men and Rosemary's Baby.
Rosemary's Baby Face, where she has to sleep her way to the top of the satanic cult.
Rosemary's Baby Boom, starring Diane Keaton.
Mm-hmm. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is a favorite film of mine. That has baby.
Yes.
Well, we're going to work on the baby Jesus thing for sure. I mean, to make Jesus into an adorable baby. Oh, wait a minute. We do that every year. I forgot. Baby Yoda, yeah. That's the whole other thing.
Oh, that's the child.
The child officially is the name of that character. Yes, the child, and Werner Herzog is the client.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
baby Werner Herzog. You guys, baby Werner Herzog.
Yeah, I was in the toy store and I saw a Funko Pop of Werner Herzog from The Mandalorian. Yes, you can get a Funko Pop of Werner Herzog now.
Wow,
and I'm very excited.
Yeah. I'm mentally making room on my shelf right now. It's like, oh.
Don't move. That's your next gift from me. I'm sending you a baby. Not a baby, but what looks like a baby Werner Herzog.
It's baby proportions for sure.
Yeah, you're getting that from me for sure. Okay, so by the way, I don't think they've done Funko Rosemary's Baby, but I'm sure they're going to because they've done Carrie.
They did The Shining.
The Shining, of course.
What did I send you? Is it
you guys both sent me, and John Solomon got me one. People have been so nice to me and gotten me all these. I have the whole collection, I think, from just from people gifting me. So thank you. And no doubt that's going to happen.
My guess is that is where the toy company who makes the Funko Pops would say, Yeah, Roman Polanski, no.
Minnie as a Funko toy, come on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is a tough one.
It's a tough one. Yeah. I mean, doing the show was a touch and go,
true.
You know.
It's true. All right. Now, before we begin the segment, so last episode I had the wonderful Nick Levin on. It was an incredibly fun show of him talking about his dad writing the book. And he mentioned, and this was a complete exclusive to this podcast, that he kind of felt maybe his father based the idea of Tannis Root, which he totally made up out of thin air. Possibly, though, that thin air included the concept of Tannin's Magic Shop. Because his father apparently would frequent Tannin's Magic Shop in New York. And it rang a bell, but I wasn't sure if I had been there. But yeah, so I wanted to just follow up on that. It does still exist. Joe's been there. I'm pretty sure I've been there, but I just didn't. You know, you live in New York long enough and you actually forget like some of the most magical things you've been to, like some of the most special, like little nooks and crannies of, you know, the incredible city this is. And I think I've actually forgotten and I need to go back. But so Tannin's Magic Shop, been around since 1925. Of course, all the legendary magicians have gone there. It's near Herald Square. I believe it's up the stairs at this point.
I recall you have to go into an office building and go upstairs. It's not a storefront. Yeah.
There you can find things such as invisible paint, I'm reading this from Atlas Obscura, multiplying billiard balls, pure smoke, the Emperor's Orange Box, and hundreds of versions of rabbit-producing hats, magic canes, dice, and cards. So, yeah, I got to go back.
I went in there once in the 80s. I bought one thing when I was there, and I think I may have gone there specifically to buy this one gag, but it was a zipper banana peel. So it was a banana peel made of vinyl, and you could zip it up and then unzip it, or you know, you could put a banana in there.
The possibilities are kind of ending, sort of.
Yeah, you could take a peeled banana, and assuming it was roughly the same proportions, put it in there and zip it up and it would look like a regular banana, but then you could unzip it, eat a little, and then zip it back up again. And that was a gag that I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, it could be a pickle in there or a harmonica.
I guess so. You could put a sausage or something.
Disembodied finger.
A dildo. Yeah. Could be many things in there.
Absolutely. A sex toy you could put in there, which is, you know, but then you can't eat it really. It's made of plastic. That's the thing.
All right. So let us begin this very long episode. But this is a scene that's just chock full of stuff. So we begin with Rosemary in front of the Time Life building. Time and Life building, as it says very clearly, and still does today, of course, written in stone. The Time and Life building. And she's looking sad. She's been waiting for Hutch, and he's just not shown up. The next shot is of Radio City Music Hall. You can see the blinking, beautiful sign. And we see the Newsweek building with the time and the temperature, you can still see today.
She's standing on 50th Street, and the camera's facing west. And then she walks into the building and speaks to the security guard, and you can see through the hallway to the other exit on the 51st Street exit, sort of looking north.
That painting that you see there is still there. You'd think it's a Mondrian, but it's not. So just quick, it's called Relational Painting number 88 from 1960. It's by Fritz Glarner, not Mondrian, but close enough.
Yeah, and
for the Time Life building.
Yeah, and I just noticed that in the window, as the camera's looking through the glass at her talking to the security guard, you can see the reflection of a Horn and Hardart on the other side of the street.
Oh yes, I did not notice that. Oh, how cool.
That is exciting. So that's now cool. We know that on 50th Street and Avenue of the Americas, on the corner opposite the Time Life building, there was a Horn and Hardart automat, which I never knew before. And now,
which we also learned in this podcast, carried complete pumpkin pies.
Yeah, that's right. I had no idea.
Besides the slices. So again, Horn and Hardart was a cafeteria where you had what are they called? You put the coin in.
Yeah, it was an automat. Yeah,
It was an automat, right? So you put the coin in. I hear the macaroni and cheese was stupendous. You'd put your coin in, you'd get your mac and cheese, you'd get your slice of pie, you'd get your tuna sandwich, and what could be more fun than that? And apparently, the food was great.
Yeah, and you could get anything from a cup of coffee to a slice of pie to a full meal, and get it out of a little machine with, like, you look in a window, there's your meal, and you put money in the machine and take it out. I only once went into a Horn and Hardart automat. There was one left in the city. It was on 42nd Street and 3rd Avenue, where there's now a Gap store.
Wow, when was that?
It was there until, I think, about 1990. But I went in there, and I think it must have been about 1984. There was a live radio broadcast. Oh, yeah, it was WNEW, the rock station at the time. 102.7. They were doing a live morning show broadcast from the Horn and Hardart automat, and they had some up-and-coming comedians who were performing live. One of them was a guy named Sam Kinison, who had been on Saturday Night Live or Letterman at once or twice, and only a handful of people knew who he was.
Wow. So she goes down into the basement, which we learn in the book, and there's a payphone there, and it's an interesting shot because her back is to us. You know, you don't see her face at all. But the phone is so much more interesting to look at, you know, in retrospect, you know, for us, you know. It's a really interesting looking real old-timey payphone. Even for 1968, it looks like it's almost from the 50s, you know.
If she went into the basement, that means where she is going is actually the concourse underneath the Time Life building, which connects with Rockefeller Center.
Right. So there's a whole underground habitat, you know, of like, you know, tunnels.
I used to love all the stores under there. There's still, I mean, I haven't been there in almost 20 years, but the last time I was there, it was great fun to like walk around all the stores. And yeah, there were a lot of new ones. There were J. Crew's and whatever. But there were also like just a very, very few of the really old little kind of greasy spoon diners that was
right,
down
there. Right, or barbershops.
Like a little, like a shoe place or something like that.
Tailors and exactly. There's still, you still see them every so often here. Yeah, it's a whole like miles of underground. You don't, if in the winter, you don't have to come out if you absolutely don't want to.
I used to go into the Time Life building years ago. Like it's going back like 30 years. I used to do illustrations for the internal employee publication for Time Life, which was called FYI. And that was back when you'd have to physically go in to deliver the artwork. So I would be working on something, you know, all night, and then in the morning I'd get on the subway and go down. And I had figured out how to get out of the subway and into the Time Life building without going outside into the street. Because you can get on a subway and then you're in this like tunnels, these tunnels underneath, and then you find the place where you go right into the building. So if it was cold or raining or something, you wouldn't have to go outside.
Now, my first job out of college was Rockefeller Center job. I was a secretary back when you would still sometimes call people secretaries for a division of Warner Brothers Records. And it was an awful job working for a crazy coke addict. But yeah, I got to know that underground system for sure, because I freaking always hated the winter. Okay, so she's talking on the phone. The person answers, yes. Is this Edward Hutchins' apartment? Yes, who's this, please? My name is Rosemary Woodhouse. I have an appointment with Mr. Hutchins. Is he there? Hello? He was taken ill this morning. Taken ill? Yes, he's in a deep coma at St. Vincent's Hospital. St. Vincent's Hospital. So that hospital no longer exists. It only closed down very recently. But I always heard terrible things about that hospital. Like, I always heard, like, don't go to St. Vincent's Hospital.
That was St. Vincent's on 7th and Greenwich?
Yeah,
okay.
It was Greenwich Village Hospital, and I always heard it was not a really good place to go, and this confirms it. They could not even diagnose for weeks he was in a coma that he had been put under a spell by witches, so that does not
Should be obvious.
He should have checked his pockets and see, well, this man only has one glove, obviously. Yes.
Clearly
witch-related.
He's a victim of a spell.
He's tested positive for witchcraft.
So RIP St. Vincent's Hospital. She says, that's awful. I just spoke to him last night at about 10:30. And the woman says, I spoke to him at 11. Who is this? You don't know me, Rosemary. I'm Grace Cardiff, Hutch's friend. And in the book, she goes on a little bit in her head about this, and she assumes that this might be some woman that he was, like, dating, maybe. So
hard to believe.
Well, he has two daughters. He has daughters.
That's
has
true. Daughters.
I mean, she's a sort of unsettling presence because of the non-specificity of what her relationship to Hutch is.
Yeah.
And also that, plus her unsettling Count Chocula accent that she has, I thought it was Nico from the Velvet Underground on the phone for a minute there. I thought,
and she's a nice kind of misdirect, because the Satanists down the hall next door never seem more than just goofy, nosy, annoying, loud, but you never get this sort of chilliness that Grace Cardiff has over the phone, where she's, the way you read it, I mean, she's like, yes, I am Hutch's friend.
It's unsettling.
She says it in a really, which it does seem like she's unnecessarily kind of blunt and harsh. I mean, when she, I love the fact that when she says, I spoke to him last night at 10. Well, I spoke to him at 11. It's like, oh, well, I guess you win then, the friend sweepstakes.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole time in this shot, you never see Rosemary's face. You just see the back of her head as she's talking on this phone. Mm-hmm. And this Hungarian accent that she has. And it just, it's unsettling. Like everything in the movie, it's just all of these little details that are set up to just put you ill at ease and make you nervous.
Well, in the book, she does say, Hutch told me all about you. You know, so he's talked a lot about you. You know, so it's a little different in the book. But yeah, I like that in the movie, there's a little bit of an unsettling quality to it. So Rosemary says, and do they know what's causing it? No, they don't know yet. At the moment, he's totally unresponsive. Oh, my God. I'm going to the hospital now. Is there anything I can do? Not really. All right. Thank you. And that's that. And again, the whole, you never see Rosemary's face. It's just completely.
And once again, you kind of miss the sort of blunt, chilly kind of, not really. It's like if you called Werner Herzog, not really.
Yes, exactly. You
know? He has been taken to the hospital. We don't know what's causing his coma. Is there anything I can do? Not really.
I spoke to him at 11 o'clock, and we mused on the nature of despair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Fan theory now. She's somehow related to Werner. I don't know. Somehow. So now we see Rosemary walking in the streets of New York, and the music gets really eerie. Like, it's like, it's like really like crazy spooky music, actually. Really great.
Yeah,
great
kind
stuff.
Of within your head freak out when you've just heard something terrible, unexpected, but you still have to go out and function until you get to your house and you can break down. And it's like your pulse is up so high, you can almost hear the circulation system in your head.
Yes, it really reflects that. Absolutely. And it's raining out. You can see it's very, the streets are shiny. I mean, it's not raining at the moment, but the streets are shiny and wet and everything. You know, it's cold. And then we cut to what I've actually brought up a few times on this podcast already, because it's my favorite detail in the whole movie, I think, is this window. It's a Tiffany's window.
Yeah. And I have to mention, first of all, that she is taking one circuitous route to Tiffany's. Because,
oh, is she?
Yeah, she starts out, she's on West 50th Street and 6th Avenue. And then the next thing we see, she's on 53rd Street and Park Avenue. And she's walking south and she turns east onto 53rd Street. And the next thing we see, she's now on 57th Street and 5th Avenue. So she's wandering all over the place. I'm a stickler for New York location stuff.
Yes.
I would like to be the official New York location consultant on this film. But yeah, she walks down Park Avenue. She walks past the Lever House building and then turns the corner. There's one of these beautiful old red and blue mailboxes, which are no longer there.
Yeah.
And just turns east onto 53rd Street. You just get a glimpse of the Seagram building as she's turning the corner, and then she's at Tiffany's.
Right. So that's inaccurate, Mr. Polanski.
Well, unless she's just taking a crazy walk, which she could be doing, because she doesn't know which way is up right now. You know?
When I was fired from that job as secretary for that division of Warner Brothers Records, which I was, by the way, by the crazy coke addict, I did the exact thing. You know, it's actually, now that you've said it, it's coming back to me. And I'm sure I heard that same music in my head, because I was like, I was so shocked. I was just wandering, and I actually got on the wrong bus to get home and ended up like on some bus off to who knows where in New Jersey. That's what she's going through. It's true. You wander. So this Tiffany's window. Now, in the book, she comes to, this exact thing happens. She comes to a window, a Tiffany's window. I don't think it says Tiffany's, but a holiday window that is of a manger scene. Now, this is not exactly a manger scene. This is a fascinating little window. This window, by Roman Polanski's incredible luck through this whole movie when he's been filming this, was already existing. This was not created by the movie, you know, by Roman or Richard Silbert or anybody involved with the movie. This was already in the window. This was the real window of December 1967. Now, let me say this. When they were shooting this movie, they began the filming in New York City with the Dakota scenes and the telephone booth scene and all that. Now, that's clearly sunny New York. It was in August of 1967. Then they filmed the entire movie within the sets in L.A. And then this is the last thing they did was December 1967. The movie came out in June 1968. December 1967, they did these last scenes. And by incredible luck, this window happened to be the window that was up. And it is so perfect for this movie. It's Mary in her blue dress holding Jesus. The baby Jesus, he looks like a toddler. Doesn't look like a baby. And he's like kind of coming off of her lap. You know, it's like he looks like he's about to like fall off or something or climb off. He's holding something that looks like a bran muffin. I don't know what it is.
I have a theory about what he's holding, but we'll get to that. I'm sure I know what he's holding, but we'll get to that.
She's in a throne, okay, with a crown on her head. On the throne are a couple of doves, but some fruits. There's like a cucumber and like a pear and all this stuff on these little shelfy things on the throne. And surrounding her are animals. Now, there's a sheep, yeah. There's a goat, yeah. There's a deer. But there's also a wolf with something in its mouth. There's a skunk. There's a
skunk.
There
is a skunk, yes. Sure. Next to, I guess it's a llama. Is that a llama?
There are
Jesus's favorite llama. Yeah.
There's squirrels.
And that's a 2L llama, not a 1L llama.
And there's a mouse.
It's a
and
creepy a mouse. Scene, yeah.
The amazing thing is, you know, the mouse fits into this movie because it's been the mouse has been a theme. You know, obviously that's talked about during the ceremony, the mouse. So it's like, how perfect is this? It's the creepiest little Mary and Jesus scene that someone could dream up. And yet it was actually what was in that window. Now, let me say, I did some research into this. The person who did the Tiffany windows for like forever, for like from, let's see, 1950s to the 80s was a man named Gene Moore, M-O-O-R-E. Now, this is not the Gene Moore who wrote the soundtrack to Carnival of Souls, which is an amazing soundtrack. Exact same name, different Gene Moore. This is Gene Moore, who was born in 1910, died in 1998. And he is just the man. He was a legend in window design. And he did like every Tiffany's window for, I mean, all year round for years and years and years. Now, the Smithsonian on its website has a archive, a black and white photo of every window he ever did. And it's amazing. I'm going to put a link on the website and you should all flip through it because it's just, his windows are stunning. They're creepy and they're beautiful and they're minimalistic and they're modern. He worked with Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, Andy Warhol. He worked with, you know, incredible artists also when he was doing this. He did about 5,000 windows.
Wow.
He often incorporated naturalistic bits. He had a stuffed hummingbird collection.
Wow.
Incorporated into it. You'll see a lot of birds. You'll see a lot of animals. You'll see a lot of like woodsy kind of scenes. But also, like I said, like really modern, like disembodied hands and like geometric things. And they're incredible. Just incredible.
Well, here's what I think the baby is holding.
Yes.
And I believe this is significant. The baby is holding a croissant.
Oui.
In reference to Audrey Hepburn standing, looking in that same window 7 years earlier, holding a croissant and a coffee in the opening scene of Breakfast at Tiffany's. Now, I think that's very intentional allusion to Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I think these films, if you look at them, that is exactly the place where Audrey Hepburn is standing.
Yes.
But also, interestingly, Audrey Hepburn is standing there so she can stare at diamonds and jewels, as you pointed out to me. Weirdly, there's no jewelry in this window. I'm not sure how this window advertises jewelry in any way.
A lot of his windows, you can barely see. That's one of the magical things about his windows is you can barely see the jewelry. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that she is wearing a necklace. If you look really carefully, you'll see a little necklace. Now, I'm going to post a black and white photo from the Smithsonian Archives of this window, but it's still like hard to make things out.
By the way, you could not ever get Breakfast at Tiffany's. That was never a thing. It's a jewelry store. There's not coffee and coffee and croissants there or anything like that. It's not like you can get like a an omelet with diamonds in it or something.
Yeah.
Until recently, when they opened a cafe inside the store, and then you could actually go to Tiffany's and get breakfast, but then they closed it. But I do want to point out that the many things that this film has in common with Breakfast at Tiffany's. It has a slender female protagonist.
Yes.
Who became a fashion icon.
Mm-hmm. Pixie haircut. At some point, Audrey Hepburn had a pixie haircut.
It has a questionable Japanese stereotype.
A few degrees less, but indeed, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's way worse in Breakfast at Tiffany's. At least the Japanese guy in Rosemary's Baby is actually Japanese. And it features a leading man often mistaken for Ben Gazzara.
Yes.
So there's a lot of connecting DNA between those two films. And I think the croissant in the baby's hand is there to symbolize that.
It could be, because here's one more little factoid about Gene Moore. He did some photography also. And so he's very well known for one of the best known portrait sittings of Audrey Hepburn in 1952.
There you go. What a connection.
Yeah, he's famous for some photos he did of Audrey Hepburn. So,
But now, I want to point out, as the official New York location consultant of this podcast, that this entire sequence where she goes from the Time Life building to Park Avenue, past the Lever House and to Tiffany's, all of these locations look more or less exactly the same today.
Yes. Yeah. I know. It's amazing. New York I mean, it's all built in stone. Nothing changes.
Yeah. The only difference is Tiffany's now is next door to Orthanc Tower, Trump Tower, actually, where unspeakable evil takes place.
Yes.
Now, I'm just going to say one more thing. If you look at the Smithsonian archives, you'll also see the window that was probably the next window over to this window. And it's very similar, but it's an angel in like a frame. And with her is a tiger, a fox, a monkey, a lion, rabbit, looks like a beaver, maybe a penguin.
Sure.
And a goat. So again, it goes perfectly with the Mary one. I don't know what this concept was, but it's amazing. I thought Roman Polanski had designed that window because it was so creepy. Yeah. And so like the wolf and the mouse, I thought this is like, what a piece of beautiful detail. Roman Polanski, this is the part of him that I agree is genius. And every time I attribute something to him, it often turns out not to be him. This is another case where it was just sheer dumb luck that he got this beautiful window. So the same year, another window that was up there was of Santa ice fishing. It's really, yeah. So I'll put those three photos will be up, and a few other examples of this wonderful man, Mr. Gene Moore, his incredible windows. Okay, so as we pull out, as the camera pulls out, who comes? We hear basically.
We hear her saying, no!
It almost sounds like a cat's
scary.
Yowl.
It's really scary. Ruth Gordon going,
yeah. I think that was a jump scare. A jump scare. Wow, no.
You're staring at this weird, serene little scene. And then
the music is spooky. Yes. And you hear, no, that was what I call the long arm of coincidence. Except I can't even do it.
Mix
I can't
those
even do it.
Metaphors.
Yeah.
That's what I call the long arm of coincidence.
Yeah. It's like, wow.
Oh, God. I said to myself, as long as Rosemary's going out, I might as well get out and do a little bit of Christmas shopping. And now here you are, and here I am. Isn't that something?
Isn't that something? I might as well get a little bit of Christmas shopping.
Did Ruth Gordon know how terrifying she was? Was it intentional? How much of it was just her?
Oh, yeah, she knew.
Yeah.
She was a good actress, I guess.
Oh, she was. As they were talking, a Gristini's truck runs by the back.
Gristini's, yes.
That's where I shop for my food. And I didn't know that it was that old of a chain. So,
well,
yeah,
I can tell you, Gristini's chain began in 1891 with one small store. At
Holy
the
cow.
Time of this film, there were 115 locations in the New York City area, and the chain had just been bought by the parent company of 7-Eleven.
Wow.
Currently, however, there are only 31 locations in existence.
The one next to me just closed, and I'm really pissed.
Yeah,
I have to walk quite a ways now to get to my Gristini's. I'm glad you knew that, because I was really shocked to see that truck. It's a really cool old truck, so check it out. If you look at that, again, everybody's listening and present time, Netflix and Amazon Prime both have got this movie running. So go follow us along on Amazon Prime or Netflix as you're listening to this podcast. I keep meaning to say that because, you know, I'm sure most people are by now must be aware of that. But okay, so she says, "Oh, darling, what's the matter? You feel all right? Oh, you poor thing. You know what I think? I think we better be going home now. What do you say?"
Aw, what do you say?
Aw, what do you say? Absolutely love the next detail. She is totally one of those people who tries to flag down a cab in New York City by using a whistle.
Her own whistle that she has. Whistle. She has it ready. It's ready.
Yes. Yes.
And that apparently, if you look,
insane.
If you look close, it's attached to her wrist by a string.
Of course.
She's that got it on her wrist, ready at any moment to hail a cab. It's just, it's a level of obnoxiousness.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is unprecedented.
So, of course, they knew where Rosemary's going today because she told God, right?
Yeah.
So then, of course, he told them. So if you can picture it, because like Joe pointed out, she walked a whole bunch of blocks from Time Life to here, probably in a stupor that made her wander even further than she should have. So they were almost certainly, you got a picture that Minnie was probably following her, right? Don't you know? Because, I mean, there's no way. There's no way she would have just bumped into her.
It's not like she can blend.
Oh, and we should say what she's wearing. She's wearing a white leather coat jacket and a very red leather hat. That's straight out of the book. That's exactly what she's wearing in the book. And it is another classic Minnie.
Yeah. And were these stolen shots? In other words, they didn't have a permit to shoot. They just kind of had a small handheld camera, kind of like when she walks into traffic
I know that
one was stolen.
I would guess, because there's people waiting to cross the street who are just sort of staring at what's going on. And I'm sure those are not paid extras. Those are just real people.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything explicitly written about how much they did that. But like, they wouldn't want that written about. Yeah, I have a feeling that's probably true. Okay, so after the whistle blows, we cut to a very dark scene in Rosemary's apartment. It's her doubled over in a chair. She's got her nighttime clothes on. She's got big fuzzy slippers on. She's clearly in pain, breathing very heavy. It's raining out. None of the lights are on. You see in the window this really spooky anatomical, like one of those wooden, what are they called, Joe? The wooden figure that artists use to pose and for life drawing.
That's called the wooden figure that artists use to pose for life drawing. I don't know that it has another name.
It's called the Woody. Yes.
So he's in the window, which makes it, like, to me, so creepy. And then the wonderful contrast on the TV, it's like all in blue because she's watching a black and white TV, is this 1930s blowout musical dancing woman with big feathered fans. All it's kind of Busby Berkeley kind of scene, right? You don't hear the sound, so you don't hear the music, but it's like she's watching this joyous dance extravaganza on stage, and she is just in the dark, doubled over, in so much pain. So it's a really beautiful little tableau.
And they don't identify what movie that is?
I tried. I really Googled like crazy. I could not find any stills. If anybody knows what it is she's watching, I would love to know what that is. I love those little details. So that's just a really quick little scene. And then we cut to a New Year's party.
Hooray! Oh, I'm so excited about this New Year's party. And I'll tell you why I'm excited about it.
Why?
Because they're about to ring in the year of my birth.
Yay!
Ah.
Yes, I'd like to point out that I was born in 66. I was born in 966, which is not quite 666, but it's very, very close.
Yes.
Because all you'd have to do is flip over the nine. And my middle name is, in reality, Damien. I'm not saying I am the Antichrist, but there is a high likelihood that I am the Antichrist. That's all I'm saying.
There was a Saint Damien, wasn't there? There was a priest, it was on Hawaii, and he took care of the lepers. He had a leper's colony. Until the omen came along, Damien was very well thought of.
Superseded by the Antichrist.
Yep.
It is a good demon name, or Antichrist name.
Damien, Damien, you know, it's a few letters.
I just don't see, I don't have saint in me, so I'm pretty sure it goes the other way.
So we are celebrating the year of the birth of Joe, and we are in the Castevet's living room, or someone's living room. Does it look like, it actually looks like it might be someone else's apartment, right?
Maybe it's Laura Louise's.
Yeah, maybe it's someone else's apartment, because I don't quite recognize it.
This of is course, not the Castevet's place?
I don't know. I just It just occurred to me that it doesn't look like the room that's in the finale. Yeah. And of course, there are other witches living in the building, so why not, you know, have a New Year's party somewhere else. Now, once again, we have the backs of people's heads. We have Dr. Saperstein, and we have Rosemary, who kind of goes in profile and back of her head quite a bit in this scene.
It's weird. She has a whole conversation with Dr. Saperstein on this couch, and you never see his face.
Yeah, you never see his face.
Mm-hmm.
But you have this wonderful view just out of focus of these elderly people with the stupid New Year's hats on, crowns and, you know, stupid goofy purple hats and whatnot. We have Saperstein saying it'll stop any day now. She says it's like a wire inside me getting tighter and tighter. Oh, can you imagine? That is such an incredible description. Like, you can picture that pain, right? He says, usually older women with less flexible joints have this sort of trouble.
Ugh.
She says, I'm not going out anymore. And he's like, you don't have to. And Roman shouts, 1 minute to go. And Minnie brings over, we're going to talk about a few of these people in the room, but this is a biggie. Minnie leads over.
I'm so excited.
Joe was so excited to get this minute. The one and only Phil Leeds is he is Dr. Shand in this movie.
Dr. Shand. And he's introduced in two weird ways, two things that are insane. One of them is that Minnie comes over with Dr. Shand to introduce him to Rosemary right after somebody says, 1 minute to go. So it's a really awkward moment to choose to introduce two people that you want to meet. Because, you know, and by the way, the 1 minute, they say Happy New Year after about 30 seconds. So I timed it.
Oh,
it's not even 1 minute to go. They're late on the minute. But then, Minnie comes over and introduces Dr. Shand as he used to be a famous dentist, which is such an odd calling card to have.
Yes, famous dentist.
Quick, one of you name a famous dentist. Go.
I'm supposed to be impressed by that. Whoa, used to be a famous dentist. I don't know. Like, currently a famous dentist isn't even impressive.
Hermes from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That's like the, and the guy from... that movie, the wonderful 70s, the dentist.
Oh, yeah, from Marathon Man.
Marathon Man, yes. Those are the two most famous dentists.
Or, you know, Dr. Orrin Scrivello from Little Shop of Horrors. You know. Now, Phil Leeds, you might recognize if you've ever watched a sitcom in the 1970s, 80s, or 90s.
Yeah.
He was very, very well-known comedian. He was a Borscht Belt comic going way back to the old, like, Catskill days. And he worked with people like Lou Jacoby, which if you didn't know Phil Leeds, you definitely don't know who Lou Jacoby is. So why am I even mentioning Lou Jacoby? It's used to work with Lou Jacoby is on the same level as used to be a famous dentist, probably, as a claim to fame. But he was around for a really long time.
He opened for like Barbara Streisand and stuff. I mean, and again, like when we say he was in the 70s sitcoms, like all of these actors, we've kind of noted that they've all done that. But him, one of the absolute most frequent. Like he's he's so distinct looking. You know,
he's so distinct looking. He has this great little weird face with no chin and a big nose. And I once did a painting of him when I was in art school. I don't remember what the assignment was, but for some reason, my solution to the assignment was to draw Phil Leeds wearing a tuxedo with a ruffle shirt and the undone bow tie. That's sort of like, you know, the Dean Martin thing with the undone bow tie. And I drew him against some sort of apocalyptic backdrop of like craters and smoke and things. And I have no recollection of why that came about, but that was a painting I did.
Do you still have it?
Wish I could find it. I can't find it. It's lost to history, unfortunately. And if you recognize him at all, you'd recognize him from the Inquisition number from Mel Brooks' History of the World, Part 1. Because he's the guy who opens the number by saying, Torquemada, he is the Grand Inquisitor.
Yes.
And, you know, do not ask him for mercy.
Yes, you can't Torquemada anything. Yeah.
You can't Torquemada nothing. Yeah, that's Phil Leeds in that movie.
Ah.
So, but he was a guy who showed up on sitcoms from The Odd Couple to Mad About You to suddenly Susan. I mean, he was like, that's a 30-year span there.
Friends. One of the biggest appearances I watched the whole episode. It's on Dailymotion. You can find it still. Is a Roseanne episode. Mm.
Well, this is something we need to talk about.
This
we should do a whole episode about this because he appeared sort of playing this same character,
right,
on an episode of Roseanne, which was a full-on parody of Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, so Roseanne, she has a dream, basically. The punchline is it's all a dream, but she kind of gets knocked unconscious, and she has this dream that she's basically kind of in the movie Rosemary's Baby. And Phil Leeds is in the episode. Other people in this episode include the Ab Fab ladies.
Playing their characters.
Yeah,
the wow. episode is Roseanne. It's from that weird last season of Roseanne where the Connors had won the lottery and were now millionaires.
They're like, the Connors are millionaires.
Yeah,
she's
that final season.
They're at a hobnobby New York City social thing with Sandra Bernhardt, who he was on the show a lot. They're with her sister, Laurie Metcalf, its character.
Jackie.
And in this is the Ab Fab duo, who I think helped write the show. Marlo Thomas.
And Arianna Huffington.
Huffington.
If you were wondering what year it was 1996. And you can tell because Arianna Huffington is in it.
Is acting, and she's not like a journalist. And
Jim J. Bullock and Kathleen Freeman, the great comedy actress from the 50s and 60s, Kathleen Freeman. And they're sort of the Castevets in it.
Yes, they're the Castevets. And you might not have noticed this, Joe, but there is a Japanese photographer in this played by Ernest Harada. It's the same guy.
I did not notice that. So they got Phil Leeds and the Japanese guy to be the same. Also, it's terrible, by the way. It's really awful. And I should also point out, through pretty much all the episode, Roseanne is wearing this plunging backless gown that shows quite a bit of butt crack.
Yeah.
And
it kind of has the whiff of like staying up all night on meth and coke and crushed and snorted, what do you call it, Vivarin.
Bring it back to Phil Leeds, which is that I think a lot of people would probably most recognize him from the Larry Sanders Show.
Yes.
He died in 1998. And so only a couple of years before that, he appeared on the Larry Sanders Show as Hank Kingsley's elderly agent.
Now, let me just do the official. He was born in 1916, born in the Bronx. You know who else was born in the Bronx?
Me.
Kubrick and Joe Dader.
And Stanley Kubrick. Yeah.
Right. And he was a peanut vendor in his youth for Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
He was in the Army for World War II. God bless him. He got into stand-up, as we said. He was at some point blacklisted all of that craziness. And some of his earlier works included The Dick Van Dyke Show, Car 54. He did a lot of these sitcoms, but he got the really hip sitcoms, like The Monkees was one of his first kind of goofy appearances. He was on Three's Company, Starsky and Hutch, Maude, some of the really cool stuff. Kojak, McMillan and Wife, Odd Couple, of course, Love American Style. He was in a Woody Allen movie, Don't Drink the Water. So he had kind of he did corny stuff, but he did hip stuff too. Barney Miller, a whole bunch of times on Barney Miller.
Yeah, I did a lot of Barney Miller's. And
he was a ghost in Ghost, the movie Ghost.
He's in the movie Ghost.
Emergency room.
Right. He was sort of a Borscht Belt comedian, and he's on this comedy album from like the early 60s called When You're in Love, the Whole World is Jewish. And which also featured the aforementioned and storied Lou Jacoby and Valerie Harper and Frank Gallup of Ballad of Irving fame. Look it up. Just look it up, okay? Ballad of Irving. Ballad of Irving. And it was a sort of sketch comedy musical album, and all of it this sort of 1960s Borscht Belt humor, where the whole joke of everything is that just make everything Jewish. It was sort of that Mel Brooks type of humor. And he sings a song. He's actually quite great. He's quite charismatic on that song, which is called Would You Believe It? And it's almost like a proto Adam Sandler Hanukkah song, because it's him talking about how Steve McQueen is Jewish and how famous celebrities are Jewish and how great it is.
Well, it's not surprising that he was great in that kind of thing, because actually he did a ton of theater, which I'm not going to go through. But I mean, you could look on the IMDb page of the, the peripheral stuff he did. He did a ton of theater. Some of it amazing. Two Gentlemen of Verona, stuff like that. And most notably for our uses is he was in, of course, Nobody Loves an Albatross, the actual play that actually existed. Yeah, he was in that play. Original cast, Nobody Loves an Albatross.
Wow.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep, yep.
Mind blown. Yeah.
I mean, it's almost eerie.
It's almost eerie. Okay.
What's happening at this New Year's Eve party?
Okay, so New Year's Eve party. So she's introduced Mr. Leeds, Dr. Shand, and he squinches his face at Rosemary. So Minnie is putting the little crazy hat on Dr. Shand, and at this point, some creepy weirdo he's not in the book, comes over and hands them both champagne and says, "Have a good year," and puts his finger to his mouth. It's the creepiest thing.
Is
Don't
that
know
not,
who he is.
Wait, that's not Mr. Nicholas?
No, that's
I
no.
could have sworn it was him.
If you just freeze on him, he's horrifying. Horrifying. And of course, famously, as soon as this happens, we have a ding, bells going off, and Roman saying, "To 1966, the year one."
The year one.
This whole scene is only
for
like
me, it was.
Yes, it was for, well, it's the year zero for Joe.
Yes.
Now, this is all just one sentence in the book. They actually don't show this scene very clearly in the book. But in the book, she kind of wonders why they say that. But she's in so much pain. She's like, yeah, but who cares? Like, she just can't put in the energy to think about it. She thinks it's like some political reference that's just going over her head. Mm. Some of the other possible guests here, again, because this was before the internet, we don't have a lot of good connections between who these actors are and who they were in real life, but a few of the possible people in this room include Fritzy Jane Courtney from Jaws, right, Joe?
The Are You Going to Close the Beaches lady.
The Are You Going to Close
supposedly in this film, but I can't find her.
I think she must be in this scene and we just can't see her because
she's a party guest.
She's a party guest. We have Walter Baldwin, who is an old-timey actor playing Mr. Weeze. He goes all the way back to 1936. General Electric Theater, Petticoat Junction. Robert Osterloh, who is another well-played, in a million things kind of actor playing Mr. Mountain. Here, completely not even in the credits. And Mona Knox, who you should look up because she looks like she's amazing, as Mrs. Byron. The background people, the background players who are getting paid like nothing, but are just happy to be there.
Did you mention
crazy...
the cat, the lady with the cat?
You're right. I totally forgot. Oh, and I never noticed this till I saw this on the big screen this year recently. Yeah, there is in this movie a cat cameo. So look out for that, listeners. There is a black cat cameo. He's sitting on the couch. You barely notice him, but he's brilliant. He nails it.
The cat.
He or she. Nails
the cat is way in the extreme background. He's very, very small in the frame, sitting on the couch, but the light catches his yellow eyes just right. So all you see is a little sort of a black cat shape with two shiny eyes.
Yeah.
Very, very small in the frame. It's as perfect as can be.
So the woman with the cat is Almira Sessions, another old-time actress. She plays Mrs. Sabatini. You know that if you read the book. Now, there was another cat in the vicinity while this was going on because Ms. Farrow brought a cat to set every day.
Aww.
She had a cat named Malcolm.
Aww.
And I believe it was a white fluffy cat. Okay, this is from the book, This Is No Dream, Making Rosemary's Baby. Farrow's closest friend on the set were Ruth Gordon, whom she had known for years, and Malcolm, whom she had known since he was a kitten. And the quote is, "I always took him to work with me, even when I was doing plays in New York," Farrow said of her feline ally. "I used to put him in my galoshes and take him to work and leave him in my snow boots."
Oh my God.
Yeah. There were two cats.
That's an extremely compliant cat.
Yes, I know. So Malcolm, hats off to Malcolm. The official Rosemary's Baby kitty and whoever this wonderful actor cat is. They also had for Mia, another thing they allowed her was a ping pong table. She apparently wanted a ping pong table. Mm. And everybody was totally into that on set.
That's also what Van Halen wanted on their tour.
Mm-hmm. I think Kubrick had ping pong tables too.
A cat, a ping pong table.
And two hard-boiled eggs.
Two hard-boiled eggs. And a paper clip, a single paper clip.
Clap.
And we hear, like, and when he says the year one, we hear the horn, like this weird demented horn blowing. It's very unsettling, that too. It's like, what? So we hear the horn blaring maniacally, and we cut to Rosemary in the kitchen, sinking her hand into a what looks like a raw chicken and pulling out the liver. In the book, it's the dripping bloody heart of the chicken, but here it's liver. Vegetarian Giblets. Mia Farrow. Yeah, vegetarian Mia Farrow actually did eat this. She took one for the team.
Wow.
And she eats it and then looks into the toaster. And it's really, it's a beautiful shot. They get such a beautiful shot of her in that toaster.
Yeah, pray for Rosemary's toaster.
I just want to say this is one more connection between this film and the Black Sabbath album Born Again. With that wonderful demon baby on the cover, which I'm so happy we get to bring that up again. Because on that album, there is the song Zero the Hero, which is a bass-driven 8-minute dirge. Thank you. Zero the Hero features the lyric, "Your life is a 6-lane highway to nowhere. You're going so fast, you're never ever going to get down there where the heroes sit by the river with the magic in their music as they eat raw liver."
What is it about raw liver and people who are attracted to the devil?
Demon babies and raw liver go together like peanut butter and jelly.
Well, I know that a lot of pregnant women get very strange kind of cravings, and also depending on, you know, it's like when the hormones kick in, your body does very strange things. You are not in control of yourself, and I think that's also a nice way of kind of proving things here, that she's so, you know, thin and wan, and instead she sees in the toaster what looks like Nosferatu.
Yeah,
you know, like Jupiter eating his what's that Goya painting, the one where he's eating one of his children and his
legs
are sticking out with the giant eyes and the giant maw. And then she throws up in the sink, which nowadays I'm sure they would do with sound effects and I was like thank God this is one of the last films to not include the sound of retching hurling
or the visuals.
That's my bugaboo. I can't handle realistic vomiting in a movie. I cannot handle it.
I don't
ever want to see it ever.
No, I don't either.
I can do cartoony vomiting. I can do Witches of Eastwick, Cherry Pits. I can do Monty Python. I cannot handle a person vomiting realistically in a movie at all.
Yes.
Here's just a quote from Mia about the raw liver, by the way. "When Roman wanted me to eat raw liver, I ate it, take after take, even though at the time I was a committed vegetarian. I trusted him all the way, and he was never wrong." So, just so you know.
It's hard to watch because it's so real.
Yeah.
It's so clearly real.
Again, when they drew the blood from her, that was a real nurse drawing her blood. So after the vomiting, we see Guy wandering the halls in his pajamas in a dark hallway. Like, he's kind of like, "Oh, where's my wife?" And he wanders over to the kitchen and sees her sitting intently punched over a book at the kitchen counter. Now, in the book, you know, she started doing this at about 4 o'clock in the morning after vomiting the chicken heart. That kind of snapped her into this mode. And that's when she decided to do this.
Yeah.
So he says, in typical Guy fashion,
his typically supportive fashion,
he says, "What the hell are you doing? Planning the menu. We're having
planning
a party
your week murder. What do you think I'm doing, Guy? Jesus.
We're having a party a week from Saturday. It's for our our young friends. Minnie and Roman are not invited. Neither is Laura Louise, nor is Dr. Saperstein. It's going to be a very special party. You have to be under 60 to get in."
Ah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. I love how long it takes him to come back with, "Well, I'm glad I made the cutoff." And she says, "That's right. You could be bartender."
Right. For a minute there, I didn't think I was going to make it. "Oh, you'll make it all right. You can be bartender." "Oh, swell. Do you think that's such a good idea? I think it's the best idea I've had in months." Great line.
Mm. And so he's upset with her at the exact moment that, say, a good husband should be thrilled.
Yeah.
Like, oh, she's got some energy now, and she's
more, you know, like herself again.
She's got a positive attitude. Right, exactly.
So he says, "Don't you think you ought to check with Dr. Saperstein first?"
Oh.
That's so great.
And her comeback is wonderful.
It's great. She's like, "What for? I'm just giving a party. I'm not going to swim the English Channel." And he says, "What about the pain?" And this is great because the camera cuts from this wide shot that they've had, and they cut right to her face, a full upper body shot. And she's like, oh, haven't you heard? It'll go away in a day or two. This is certainly a turning point. This is obviously, this is the first time, like, her being sarcastic with Guy is an absolute, for us, you know, a signal of her, the complete shift in her, you know, obviously. It's the beginning of things clicking for her. And she's sort of realizing this is not making any sense.
She's listening to her Aunt Fanny.
Yes, her Aunt Fanny. So the next scene is Minnie is in the kitchen. She's put together the ingredients for this awesome choupe. That's the dish. Choupe. South American casserole soup or stew kind of thing.
Shrimp.
In the book, it says it's Chilean, but I think it's a general South American dish.
There's shrimp. There's the biggest fucking lobster tail I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, yeah. It makes me want lobster.
It looks like it's going to fight Godzilla.
It did and lost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, no, there's a plate of shrimp, and then there's the plate of a freaking sea monster right there next to it.
Now, Minnie comes in, and in the background, once again, we hear piano playing for Elise. And I think that's really interesting that it's always heard in the kitchen. So obviously, whatever neighbor is constantly practicing Beethoven's Für Elise is located, you know, their window is above their kitchen, right? You know, it's always the same song. I think it's interesting that we will see soon that one of her best friends is named Elise.
Who's in that kitchen? Weird.
Who's in that kitchen?
One of her girlfriends.
I was trying to put meaning to it. I don't think there is any meaning. You know, I think it's just a New York City living note. You hear your neighbors performing opera, practicing their guitar, practicing their piano. This is typical New York stuff.
Also, public domain saves money.
It's public domain. Right. And it's public domain.
Also, it's the easiest Beethoven piece you can I could play it on a piano.
It's the kind of thing that people are practicing when they're learning piano. And it does have a spooky element to it. Like, it's definitely would go under the category of haunting melody, I would say. But I think it's, if you wanted to project some, again, fan theory onto it, which I will right now, is Elise, her best friend Elise, and we'll see her come up a couple times in the movie. If only she was more connected to her friend Elise, like a lot of this would not have, you know, it's like Elise is kind of the reality more than even her family. She's the foot in reality. And it's almost like someone in the distance is reminding Rosemary of like what she should be thinking about, you know? So anyway.
Is it in my the book?
No, not in the book.
Okay.
Not in the book. So Minnie says, that's interesting. What's it for? And she says, we're having some people over on Saturday. Oh, you feel up to entertaining? Yes, I do. These are old friends I haven't seen in a long time. They don't even know that I'm pregnant. I'll give you a hand if you like. I'll help you dish things out. No, thank you, Minnie. I can manage it. It's going to be a buffet and we're getting a bartender. Oh, I'll help you take the coats. Oh, no, really. You're, you know, too much. Well, let me know if you change your mind. Drink your drink, you know. I'd rather not. Not right this minute. I'll drink it in a little while. Well, don't let it stand. No, I won't wait too long. You go on back. I'll bring the glass back to you later. No, I'll wait. I'll save you the walk. No, you'll do no such thing. It makes me very nervous when people watch me cook. She, like, for the first time, you know, really ejects Minnie from the premises. She, like, walks her, practically shoves her to the door. Now scoots.
I love how she goes, drink your drink.
Yeah, drink,
drink your drink. Drink your drink. Drink your drink.
And the last thing she says is, don't let it stand too long. It's going to lose its vitamins.
Right. And that's how vitamins work.
Yes, that's how vitamins work. And so to further further stamp onto our brains that we're in Act Two, we see her dump the concoction down the drain.
Yeah, I love the editing here, how it goes from, as she's dumping it down, you hear, you dirty little thing.
Yep.
And it cuts to her friend. In other words, she's talking about her hiding the fact that she's pregnant from her friends. But, you know, it's kind of her being a sneaky little devil, you know, haha.
Yes,
Pouring out her drink instead of drinking it like a good girl.
Well, I wanted to point out that they do that to great effect a bunch of times in this movie, where they start the sound from the next scene just a split second before you see it. I love that. Love it. It's such a good effect.
Too. Very effective.
Yeah. So we are boom within the party, and this glorious redhead who is wearing a wig because she's blonde, a big red wig, is the character Joan. You dirty, stinking secret keeper. Congratulations. And she is actually a friend of Sharon Tate's.
But not not Sharon Tate herself. She is not in this.
Oh, yeah. Yes, you know that there is a rumor that Sharon Tate is somewhere in the background at this party. Do not, it is not. I've looked at every frame. I know, and you can tell Sharon Tate had a very distinct face. Sharon Tate's not in this at all. But so this woman is Marion Gordon Rogers, and the Rogers part of her name comes from Kenny Rogers because she was married to Kenny Rogers for 17 years.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah.
So is this when he was in the first edition? Is that the first edition
No.
playing? What music is playing? It sounds like pop music.
That's still Comida. All of the music is Comida. He just made it, you know, so it sounded like somebody else's music, some groovy band. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great work with him. But she was not Rogers at this point. I believe she was yet to be married, but she will in the near future become Kenny Rogers' wife. Her name is Marion Gordon, and she was born in Athens, Georgia. And another great thing, which goes well with the Kenny Rogers, is probably the biggest part of her career after this was being on Hee Haw, the
wow.
incredible show Hee Haw. Now, youngins who don't know what Hee Haw is... Hee Haw was inspired by...
It was a variety show, music and sketch comedy, but it all had a country, southern kind of a...
Corny as Iowa in August. So corny.
Yeah.
It was brilliant, brilliant, like jaw-droppingly amazing musicians and crazy, like the equivalent of vaudeville hillbilly jokester, you know,
yeah,
humorists.
Like Buck Owens and Roy Clark doing music, and they were sort of the two presenters, but then you had comedians like Minnie Pearl and Junior Samples, who were, you know, they were the hillbilly equivalent of Phil Leeds was to the was to the Catskills Jewish community. Mm-hmm. They were to the Ozarks.
Yeah. And this show was literally inspired by Laugh-In. And I have a feeling like these were all Grand Ole Opry. Yeah. You know, it's a lot of Grand Ole Opry people who were doing this stuff and then saw Laugh-In and was like, we do this stuff, but we do it our way. Let's do a show. You know, let's put on a show. And it really is similar to Laugh-In, except for that it's just a completely different culture. And it's fantastic. I loved it as a kid. I adored it. You know, it's so stupid, like a lot of stupid jokes. People like popping out of the cornfield telling jokes. Sketch comedy.
Yeah. I used to love the Doom, Despair, and Agony on Me song. That was my favorite.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like these really amazing,
deep,
mournful...
it was Deep Dark Depression, Excessive Misery. Yes. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Doom, Despair, and Agony on Me.
Yeah, there's like some weird dark humor. It's really pretty amazing show. I mean, for, you know, something you would never see now, for sure.
Oh, I remember the other one was Where, Oh, Where Are You Tonight? Yeah. Why Did You Leave Me Here All Alone?
I searched the world over and thought I found true love.
You met another and you was gone. There we go.
Written by the same person who wrote Fools Such As I.
Oh.
Yep. Yeah.
Amazing.
You're gone.
And you know, like Loretta Lynn and Charlie Pride and all these amazing, you know.
I'm sure
like
Dolly Parton was on there at least once.
Dolly Parton. I mean, amazing people performed. And, you know, so it was like an incredible cornucopia of entertainment.
Cornucopia.
So that's Hee Haw. She also, she was in an Annette Funicello kind of movie, bikini movie and all that stuff. So Marion Gordon, here's what she had to say about this filming. I never told them this, but I didn't completely read the script. It upset me so much. I remember being in bed and reading the script, and when it began to seem macabre, I thought, oh, what is this? And then I read a little more, and I thought, I don't want to finish this, and I had to put it down. I thought, I think all I have to do is read my part, and I could get the gist of what's kind of supposed to be doing the reading. So I saw in another article with her, she came from a Christian background, and this script just freaked her out way too much. So she never knew what was going on in the movie. She did not know what the story was. And then next, Rosemary is greeted by an African-American woman whose character name is Rain Morgan. According to the book, Rain Morgan is the date of Guy's agent, whose name is now escaping me. And she is in her Star Trek kind of glory. I love her makeup and her sparkly dress. She looks amazing, but like borderline Star Trek almost. And then we have orange gown and fur in the background going, hey, Rosie, and telling her that a couple of guests are stuck and are on their way. And then cool print dress woman, I'm calling her, who I wish I could find these actresses and actors' names. Rainn Morgan was played by Gail Peters, but the others, I just could not, I tried really hard. I could not figure out who was who. But Cool Print Dress, who has a lot of lines later, says, "Oh, you're so lucky. It's a, such a fantastic house," which I love that they call it a house, which is very New York. We all call our apartments houses. I don't know why, but we stupidly do that. And then someone comes to the door with a bouquet of flowers. And he is either Pedro or Mike. In the book, it's a couple, but here it's just one guy. And he says, "You look like a piece of chalk," which is a great line.
Yeah, although he's English, so it might be a huge compliment.
Yeah. In the book, oh, he says, "You look like a bottle of iodine."
Yikes.
I thought that was interesting. Interesting.
That's a very, I'm thinking, let's see. Nope, I can't think. I don't see the, unless iodine bottles in England were kept in very, very long, skinny, pale.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, that seems like that would be a nice thing to tell someone because it would mean shapely and maybe sort of brown. I don't know. They keep iodine in one of those like brown glass bottles. So, you know, she looks shapely and brown, like a bottle of iodine. I would love some iodine right now, baby. I don't know if that, you know. But he says, "You look like a piece of chalk." And then he says, "Make sure he's feeding you. Make sure he's feeding you, darling." Yeah, make sure he's feeding you.
As if a guy can make meals. That's hilarious.
Yes, you look like a piece of chalk.
And by the way, she's wearing her princess dress, the one that
The red robe with the white collar.
It's a beautiful red shift dress with a lace white collar. And then later when Princess, what's her friggin' name? Kate Middleton. When she had a baby, she wore the same dress and everybody went, "Rosemary's Baby."
Yeah.
Remember that?
Okay. That's right. Same dress. I knew I had seen it compared recently and I was like, oh shit.
That's what it was,
Which person was it who wore that? Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
And so a group of guests are talking and saying Adrian Marcato lived here, and Guy says, "Yeah, and the Trench sisters too." Trench sisters? Trench, they ate little children. He doesn't just mean they ate them, he means they ate them. Like, I don't even know what
what does that mean?
I don't want to know what that means.
What are the there's no middle ground. You either eat someone or don't.
There's not a lot of splitting hairs when you say they ate people.
Now, in that group, I believe, is a man named Craig Littler. And he plays Jimmy, and I think he's the guy sipping the drink. The next scene, we see two women in huge fur coats, like they look like they're walking corn on the cobs covered in fur.
Wait, is one of them Elise?
No, neither one of those is Elise. One of them...
Because that would solve a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
Fur Elise.
It's
a pun!
So right. One of them, I did determine that one of them is the actress. Irene Kelly is one of the actresses. She was in a couple of horror movies. She was in Star Trek. She's in Quincy. Enter the Devil, 1972. Original Star Trek. Original Recipe Star Trek. Mission Impossible. Enter the Devil. So pretty cool. She's the darker haired, taller fur coat that's walking by. Now there's two guys on the side there, what looks like smoking pot, right?
Yep.
And we have to talk about this because the main guy smoking pot, who's got sunglasses on and looks a bit like, to me, looks a bit like Adam Devine from Workaholics. I'm pretty sure I have definitively identified pot smoking guy. And I'm very excited to announce that I'm almost 100% certain that that is Floyd Muttrix. And Floyd Muttrix, who went on to be a writer-director, who directed the movie American Hot Wax, and which was a terrific movie.
I was like, okay, wait for the punchline. No, you're right.
That's
American Hot Wax, which is a terrific movie about the early days of rock and roll that co-stars Lorraine Newman and Jay Leno, weirdly.
Wow.
And it's about the rise of Alan Freed. And then went on to make a movie I like a lot called The Hollywood Nights with Michelle Pfeiffer and Tony Danza. It's a kind of an Animal House ripoff. It's definitely a movie that got greenlit because Animal House was a hit, because it takes place in the 60s and it's about wild, crazy guys doing crazy stuff. And Robert Wool is in it as the sort of Belushi. He's the craziest one of them all. But it's a good movie. It's actually a really enjoyable, sweet picture. And he did a lot of other things. Floyd Muttrix as a producer in the 1990 Dick Tracy film and a lot of other things. But the most exciting project that he was involved with, I've uncovered, which was the same year, 1968, that he is shown smoking pot in Rosemary's Baby. He appeared in a low-budget film called Mary Jane, which I can only describe as a potsploitation film. It's basically like Reefer Madness 15 years later. So it's about a group of juvenile delinquent hippies who smoke pot and go and do terrible crimes. And it stars the star Fabian, who was a singer. It stars Fabian as a teacher who's trying to make sure that one of his star students does not get involved with this terrible group of juvenile delinquents. It features this gang of juvenile delinquents harassing a service station attendant at a Texaco. And the service station attendant is played by a young Gary Marshall.
Oh, wow. Nice. Yes. Nice.
And I'm 100% certain that the character who appears in that as a character named Ollie, that's the pot smoking guy in Rosemary's Baby.
Right. That's it's a great name. It's a great name. Floyd Mutrux. Mutrux. I wish my name was
Floyd
Mutrux.
He also, I think, was involved in the creation of the movie The Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Oh,
as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think the other guy who's there smoking with him is named Ken Luber. And so I'm pretty sure just by matching faces, that's who it is. And I have a quote from him, also from, again, The Making of Rosemary's Baby. He's talking about Polanski. This is not a quote. During the filming, the energetic director practiced quick draws with a prop six shooter. And at the end of the shoot, the crew bestowed upon him a real one with his name and with his name inscribed on the handle. And Mr. Luber says he'd have his six guns out, and he had a cowboy there that was a six gun draw expert who was one of the best in Hollywood. So he's teaching, and Roman would be sitting there. He's a little bitty guy. Everybody has to bring that up every time they talk about Roman. He's a little bitty guy. And I'm sitting there as a young actor looking at all this going, so this is movie making, huh? This is the big time. Marveling at all of the ridiculousness. Next, we have the bartender, Renato. And he says, I make the first one strong to get them happy. Then I go light and conserve. Eh?
Smart. smart bartending there. Worth every penny he charged.
He's played by Benito Prezia. He is an Italian guy who has a few decent credits to his name. And then we see Elise. Now, I haven't mentioned Elise. She is played, of course, by the wonderful, what's her name? Emmeline Henry.
The unforgettable what's her face.
Emmeline Henry. Now, we love Emmeline Henry because we grew up with those of us who are Gen X and above, we remember Amanda Bellows, of course, from I Dream of Jeannie. She played a wife, which was a very 70s role. Wife. But Amanda Bellows was very cool wife, cool TV wife. I Dream of Jeannie, 1966 to 1970. So she was right in the middle of the height of her sitcom fame when she filmed this, which is pretty interesting. Earlier, her biggest series stint was on Mickey, starring Mickey Rooney from 1964 to 65.
The aforementioned Japanese caricature, Mickey Rooney.
And she's great in this movie. She's good because there's something about her that is very authoritative. She plays a good voice of reason, you know? She has that feel about her. So as Guy looms in the background, just out of focus.
He looms, doesn't he? He really looms. Like it's
like impending doom or it's danger. Really,
but it's really well shot because they're she's having this conversation with Elise in the foreground. In the background, Guy is sort of half talking to the bartender, but half keeping his eye on Rosemary to make sure that, God forbid, she should not be in any way influenced by anyone other than the cult of Satan.
And she says, Rosie, do you feel okay? You look tired. And Rosemary says, yeah, well, thanks for the understatement. And Elise says, how do you like CC Hill? Isn't he a dream boy? Which is funny way to describe your doctor, who is between your legs while you're giving birth.
And especially with that creepy pedophile mustache Charles Grodin has. Right, and that right. I would not, unless she's being very sarcastic, calling him a dream boy.
Let's pretend.
Charles Grodin never was a dream boy in anything.
No. He was not a snack.
And we end the scene with Rosemary saying, but I'm not going to him. And so that was quite a bunch of stuff we just went through. So we're not going to have some after discussion tangent this episode.
That was plenty.
That was plenty. Now, the next episode is my... Really, for me, I think it's my favorite scene, except for, you know, the finale is, of course, just perfection. But the next episode is my favorite, really my favorite scene in the movie. And there's so much to talk about some of the other guests at the party and what was going on in real life that fed into what happens in the next scene. It's a really important scene. So everybody come back for that.
Big teaser for the next episode. Yeah,
is that the confrontation between the post-party between Rosemary and Cassavetes?
It's one of the longest. I mean, there's a lot of really long takes in this movie, but this is, again, one of those really long takes. And it's Rosemary and Guy having it out after the party. And it's a scene that just gets me every time. It gets to me every time.
Same here. Is that not fair to Dr. Saperstein?
Well, don't spoil it. Don't spoil it for me, because I'm watching the movie in real time along with the show. So don't spoil it.
He has no idea what's happening.
Pull the trigger. Watch the whole movie, Joe.
Yeah. I'm still thinking, I'm rooting for Rosemary. She's gonna get out of this one.
So listen, you guys, I'm going to have you on again in a few episodes. I have you on like every maybe 3 or 4 episodes, kind of timed out. Now, I was thinking maybe for next time, and I'm going to say this on the air so that you're a little bit committed to it, but maybe we could watch the remake, the 2014...
Was it Zoe Saldana?
Yeah, Zoe Saldana. Yeah. So this was...
pre-Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, 2014, 2-part, 4-hour miniseries, takes place in Paris. And it's It's very different. And so I would love it if you guys don't mind. Next time, let's all convene. We'll do a little post-segment discussion of that, because I'd love to hear your take on that.
I will pencil it in.
Excellent. Yes. All right. Well, thanks, you guys, for being on once again. You're the best.
Thank you.
May I say goodbye to the listeners?
Say, please, please. They are waiting for you to say that.
Thank you once again for listening. I'm Joe Dater saying, drink your drink.
Drink your drink. Drink your drink.
Drink your drink.
Drink your drink.
Drink your drink.
Drink your drink.
Thank you so much to Megan Dooley and Joe Dater for being my guests this week. Joe videotaped the exact walk. He videotaped from the point of view of someone walking, as if you were Rosemary, the exact walk she did from the Time Life building to the Tiffany window. So it's pretty cool. So I'm going to have a link to that up, rosemarysbaby666.com, where I put up a bunch of photos from Jean Moore's windows, of course, including the ones I talked about. And Joe gave me a bunch of really cool links, some Phil Lead stuff. So do check that out. It's a lot of fun stuff on my website. I am in the middle of trying to move out of New York City, so I've been a little bit slow, and so I'm doing about an episode every 2 weeks, so apologies for not cranking them out like most podcasters, and thank you for your patience. Please do follow and subscribe to my podcast so that you do get these episodes when they come out. Follow me on Twitter and on Facebook, and please come back for the next episode, episode number 12. When we will hear Rosemary saying, "It's alive! Guy, it's moving! It's alive! It's all right!" And then when he puts his hand on her, she'll say, "Don't be scared, it won't bite you."